Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine you're standing on the front lines of healthcare, maybe in an emergency department, a busy psych unit, or, even a community clinic. You're going to encounter patients with incredible complexities, and one condition that demands both deep understanding and really compassionate care is bipolar disorder. It's a mental health challenge defined by significant, often quite dramatic, shifts in mood, energy, and overall functioning. Today, we're doing a crucial deep dive, specifically tailored for you, future nursing professionals. We're drawing insights from a comprehensive study guide on bipolar disorders and a bunch of related materials. Our mission is pretty clear: to pull out the most crucial, actionable bits of knowledge and insight, basically giving you a vital shortcut to being thoroughly well-informed. We want to equip you with the foundational understanding you'll need for truly effective patient care and management, not just for exams, right, but for the real world. We'll explore the various types of bipolar disorder, the common symptoms, key assessment methods, and crucial treatment strategies. And we'll always keep your indispensable role as a nurse right at the forefront. To truly understand bipolar disorder, to see past the sometimes misleading surface, we first need to get a handle on the unique language and the core mood states involved. Here's where it gets really interesting and, frankly, absolutely critical for your practice, when we learn to distinguish between these nuanced feelings that can define an entire episode.
Right. Then it's the precision in these definitions that really stands out. It allows for a precise clinical assessment that guides, well, everything else you'll do. For a nurse, recognizing these distinct mood states is fundamental. They form the very foundation of how bipolar disorder actually manifests. Let's start with elevated mood. Now, this isn't just feeling good after, a great cup of coffee or a nice chat. This is feeling extremely, almost unnaturally happy. It's often described as being on top of the world. There's typically a high sense of self-importance, a kind of euphoria, or maybe an intense, often exaggerated aesthetic feeling. And here's the critical insight for you as a nurse. An extremely positive mood, this euphoria, can paradoxically be just as dangerous as profound distress. It's often the smokescreen behind which the most impulsive, risky decisions are made. So it becomes a critical and sometimes counterintuitive red flag. You'll need to learn to look beyond that surface cheerfulness.
That's a really important point. So it's not just about recognizing sadness, but also recognizing that extreme high as potentially problematic.
Exactly. Building on that, we have an expansive mood. This is characterized by a distinct lack of restraint in expression, almost an uninhibited quality that kind of overflows into social interactions. There's an overvalued sense of self-importance that's often on display, coupled with a constant, sometimes indiscriminate, enthusiasm. Let's imagine our hypothetical patient, Maria, a 22-year-old nursing student, experiencing this. If Maria were presenting with an expansive mood in a clinical setting, what might you observe? Well, you might see her being overly familiar with staff, maybe addressing you by your first name without invitation, interrupting frequently, talking excessively, maybe making grand, unrealistic plans without thinking about consequences.
Right, like suddenly deciding to travel the world with no money.
Precisely. Or she might offer unsolicited advice to other patients, or even try to take charge of the unit environment. These behaviors would be key. Observable cues in your nursing assessment, signaling that her judgment is likely impaired.
Okay, and then there's the irritable side.
Yes, on a very different part of the spectrum, there's irritable mood. This is pretty straightforward, definition-wise, being easily annoyed and easily provoked to anger. It's crucial for you as nurses to understand this. Many people, perhaps even some less experienced nurses, might initially mistake intense irritability for just, a difficult patient or a bad attitude.
How do we avoid that trap?
That's the key question. How do we peel back that layer and recognize it as a clinical symptom rather than just a personality trait, especially when safety could be involved? It's not about accepting the behavior necessarily, but understanding its roots. You might observe a patient like Maria clenching her fists, maybe her tone rising rapidly, or even physically tensing up when a minor request is made, or a routine is slightly altered. In a hospital environment, this obviously has significant safety implications. A patient in an irritable mood might lash out verbally, become easily agitated, or even potentially aggressive. So your understanding of this mood state directly informs your de-escalation strategies and your environmental safety planning. Your role then isn't to confront the anger head-on, but perhaps to validate the underlying feeling, something like, "I can see you're feeling very frustrated right now, Maria," and then gently redirect or offer choices to help them regain a sense of control, all while ensuring the environment stays safe for everyone.
That makes sense. Validating the feeling without validating aggressive behavior.
Exactly. And finally, we have mood lability, which is a highly dynamic state. It can be particularly disorienting for patients and, frankly, challenging for caregivers and staff, too. It refers to rapid and frequent shifts in mood, often occurring with little or no change in external circumstances. It's like watching a quick change artist, but their costume changes are these sudden emotional shifts, often with no clear trigger.
So up and down very quickly.
Very quickly. One moment, Maria might be euphoric, planning her next big adventure. The next, intensely irritable over some perceived slight. And then quickly shift to profound sadness or despair, sometimes all within minutes. This can be particularly challenging, as I said. So how might this present in a patient's communication? Well, you might observe abrupt changes in topic, tone, or emotional expression that just don't seem connected to the conversation you're having. It makes consistent communication really difficult. For you as nurses, that means having to constantly adapt your communication style, almost like adjusting your sails to sudden shifts in the wind, just to maintain any kind of therapeutic connection. Recognizing this ability helps you anticipate and adapt your interactions, maintaining patience and a steady, grounding approach amidst that emotional turbulence.
So these are the individual mood building blocks, the sort of foundational states you'll be identifying. But when these states become prolonged and intense, when they create a significant departure from someone's usual self, that's when they form distinct episodes that are central to diagnosis, right?
Mm.
A full-blown manic episode sounds incredibly disruptive, totally overwhelming. But is there a less severe version that's just as important for us to recognize?
Yeah, and this raises a crucial question. How do we differentiate between just a passing mood, maybe a bad day or a really good day, and a clinical episode that actually requires intervention? It fundamentally comes down to duration and impact. A manic episode is defined as a distinct period of abnormally and persistently elevated, expansive, or irritable mood. And importantly, abnormally and persistently increased goal-directed activity or energy. Think of it like an emotional engine stuck in overdrive lasting at least 1 week.
At least a week.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. And crucially, this isn't just a bad week or a particularly energetic period. It is pervasive. It clouds reasoning and judgment, significantly interfering with interpersonal relationships, social functioning, or occupational functioning. As nurses, you'll see how this profoundly affects a patient's ability to care for themselves or make sound decisions. It often leads to hospitalization for safety and stabilization. Imagine Maria, maybe convinced she can go days without sleep, suddenly quitting her nursing program to, I don't know, become a professional gamer, racking up thousands in debt for equipment she doesn't need. That's the kind of pervasive, life-altering impact we're talking about.
Okay, that paints a clear picture. So the less severe version.
Absolutely there is, and it's vital to recognize. Bringing this into the wider lens of patient presentation, it's critical for you as nurses to understand a hypomanic episode. This is indeed a less severe form of mania. The symptoms, while still a distinct change from their usual self, are not as disruptive to daily functioning or their social or occupational relationships. It's still a distinct period of elevated, expansive, or irritable mood and increased activity or energy, but it typically lasts at least 4 consecutive days, so a shorter duration than a full manic episode.
4 days versus 1 week.
Correct. And the key distinction is that it does not involve the severe impairment or psychotic features, things like delusions or hallucinations, that you might see in a full manic episode. For nurses, this means recognizing subtle shifts that might not immediately scream crisis, but still warrant attention and careful assessment. A patient like Maria might be more talkative, have increased energy, start multiple projects, maybe feel exceptionally productive, but she might still be able to go to work or manage some daily tasks, even if she's struggling behind the scenes. This distinction is crucial for accurate diagnosis and tailoring the right care, potentially preventing an escalation to a full manic state.
Understanding these core mood states and episodes really helps categorize the different forms of bipolar disorder you'll encounter.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this all mean when it comes to the specific diagnoses you'll see in your practice? These aren't just labels, are they? They're more like guides for how we approach care.
That's a crucial point. The precise criteria delineate each type, and that guides appropriate interventions and informs your nursing care plan directly. Let's start with bipolar I disorder. Its defining feature, the absolute key, is the occurrence of at least one full manic episode. That's the diagnostic anchor, the hallmark that sets it apart. Now, these manic episodes may be preceded or followed by hypomanic episodes or major depressive episodes, so the patient's history could include other mood states, but that experience of full mania is the key.
Got it. The mania is the defining feature for bipolar 1.
Exactly. And the mood during a manic episode in bipolar is pervasive and significantly interferes with their relationships, their reasoning, their judgment. As nurses, this is often the most acute presentation you might see in an inpatient setting. It demands immediate nursing attention to safety and stabilization. Patients might be highly agitated, making impulsive decisions that endanger themselves or others, or perhaps experiencing delusions. Maybe Maria believes she's been chosen for a secret government mission or something like that. Your role here is critical in managing their acute needs, everything from de-escalation techniques to ensuring medication adherence, all within a safe and therapeutic environment.
And bipolar 2, how does that differ? It sounds like there's a key distinction here, maybe one that can be easily missed if you're not looking closely. I've often heard people talk about the sort of hidden nature of bipolar 2. It makes me wonder how many patients are walking around undiagnosed, especially if their hypomanic episodes just feel like a productive week to them. Can you paint a picture of what a nurse needs to look for that might be easily overlooked?
Yeah, placing this in perspective, the absence of full mania is the critical differentiator for bipolar 2 disorder. This type is characterized by a lifetime experience of at least one major depressive episode and at least one hypomanic episode, critically, without ever having a full manic episode.
So, depression plus hypomania, but never full mania.
Precisely. And this distinction is incredibly important for you as nurses because, as you rightly point out, patients with bipolar 2 often present primarily seeking help for their depression. Their hypomanic episodes may be overlooked or misunderstood, maybe even downplayed by the patient themselves or by healthcare providers. This can sometimes lead to a misdiagnosis of major depressive disorder. Imagine Maria comes to the clinic feeling profoundly depressed, exhausted, unable to focus, her studies are failing. If you only focus on the depression, you might miss the subtle historical cues. She might have periods, if you ask carefully, where she felt on fire, needed only 4 hours of sleep a night, started a dozen creative projects, felt exceptionally charming and charismatic, experiences she might even look back on fondly, describing them as her most productive times.
Ah, so she might not even see those times as a problem.
Exactly. For nurses, this means being particularly astute in your assessment. You need to inquire thoroughly about past periods of elevated mood, increased energy, or decreased need for sleep, even if the patient didn't perceive them as problematic or severe enough to seek help at the time. A careful medication history is also vital here. Why? Because antidepressants, if used alone without a mood stabilizer, can sometimes trigger hypomanic episodes in individuals with underlying bipolar 2. This could potentially worsen their condition instead of helping the depression. So you're looking for those subtle, sometimes almost positive-sounding red flags that hint at something more than just depression. It requires careful, detective-like questioning.
Okay, so we have the full-blown mania bipolar fourth and the depression punctuated by hypomania and bipolar two. But what about those whose symptoms don't quite fit these two neat categories, yet they still experience significant and persistent mood fluctuations?
Right, this raises an important question about chronic, less severe mood disturbances. This brings us to cyclothymic disorder. This is defined as a chronic mood disturbance lasting at least 2 years in adults or 1 year in children and adolescents. It involves numerous periods of hypomanic symptoms and depressive symptoms that do not meet the full criteria for a hypomanic episode or a major depressive episode.
So the ups and downs are there, but they're milder and don't last as long as full episodes.
Exactly. The key here is that the symptoms are persistent, kind of a constant up and down, but milder. They never quite reach the intensity or duration required for a bipolar half or two diagnosis. Imagine Maria experiencing a continuous sort of low-level oscillation weeks of feeling a bit down, low energy, maybe withdrawn, but still managing, followed by weeks of feeling unusually upbeat, more outgoing, perhaps slightly impulsive, but again, not to the point of full hypomania or mania. For you as nurses, this means the focus shifts towards long-term symptom management and coping strategies for these chronic fluctuating moods. These patients might not require acute inpatient care as frequently, but they definitely need ongoing support for lifestyle management, stress reduction, maybe psychotherapy, and adherence to treatment plans aimed at preventing escalation to a full bipolar diagnosis down the road.
It's also crucial to consider external factors that can mimic these symptoms, right? It's not always an inherent bipolar disorder.
Absolutely vital. We need to zero in on the need for a thorough medical and substances use history to rule out other potential causes. We have what's called substance medication-induced bipolar disorder. This is where bipolar-like symptoms, mania, hypomania, or depression are directly attributable to the physiological effects of a substance. This could be a drug of abuse, like stimulants such as cocaine or amphetamines or even hallucinogens sometimes. Or importantly, it could be a prescribed medication.
Like what kind of medication?
Well, for example, some corticosteroids, like prednisone, used for inflammatory conditions, can sometimes induce manic or psychotic symptoms. Certain antidepressants, as we mentioned, can trigger mania in susceptible individuals. Even things like thyroid hormones, if the dose is too high, can cause manic-like symptoms. So a core nursing role is to meticulously review medication lists, prescription over-the-counter, supplements, conduct thorough substance use screenings, and ask specific non-judgmental questions about drug and alcohol consumption. You need to rule these factors out before a primary mental health diagnosis is finalized. It really is like detective work, because misattributing symptoms could lead to incorrect and potentially harmful treatment.
That makes sense. Always look for other causes first.
And expanding on that, always keep in mind that other general medical conditions can cause manic-like symptoms too. This reinforces the need for comprehensive assessment and collaboration with the entire medical team. Conditions like thyroid dysfunction, hyperthyroidism, especially certain neurological conditions like brain tumors, multiple sclerosis, or even infections affecting the brain can present with mood and behavioral changes that mimic bipolar disorder. This holistic view is just a cornerstone of nursing practice. You simply can't treat the mind effectively without considering the body.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit more and consider how prevalent these conditions actually are and how they manifest across different demographics and age groups. This seems vital for anticipating what you might actually see in practice and tailoring your care, recognizing that, say, a 10-year-old might present very differently from a 70-year-old.
Yeah, a crucial point here involves the prevalence rates and the subtle yet significant differences observed across populations. This deeply informs how you, as nurses, should approach assessment and patient education. For epidemiology, the lifetime prevalence for bipolar II is estimated around 1.1%, and for bipolar II, it's about 1.4%.
So together, that's around 2.5% of the population.
Roughly, yes. Which is a significant number. A key takeaway for nurses is the typical age of onset. It usually occurs before age 25. This means you will frequently be working with young adults, like our example Maria, who are just starting to navigate a chronic mental illness during really critical developmental stages. This impacts their education, career choices, relationship formation, family planning, everything. Understanding this early onset is crucial for supporting them through these turbulent periods, helping them build resilience and integrate treatment effectively into their burgeoning adult lives.
That early onset statistic is really striking, especially for young adults trying to find their way. Now, do we see any differences between genders in how bipolar disorder presents, or is it pretty much the same experience for men and women?
Well, this raises an important question for tailoring patient education and intervention strategies. While there are no overall gender differences in the incidence of bipolar disorder, meaning men and women develop it at roughly the same rates, there are distinct patterns in how it often manifests. Males, for instance, tend to have a higher risk for experiencing more classic, sometimes more outwardly disruptive, manic episodes.
Okay.
This can lead to more urgent presentations in emergency settings, perhaps due to significant risk-taking behaviors or aggressive outbursts during mania. Females, on the other hand, have a higher risk for experiencing depression and also rapid cycling.
Rapid cycling. What does that mean exactly?
Rapid cycling means they experience four or more distinct mood episodes, mania, hypomania, depression, or mixed states within a single 12-month period. So here's a deeper insight for nurses. This means a female patient might spend more time in depressive phases, which can be debilitating, and her rapid cycling could complicate medication management significantly and make stabilization more challenging. As nurses, this informs how you might educate patients on their specific risk factors and symptom presentation. For female patients, you might focus more on recognizing early signs of depression, the challenges associated with rapid mood shifts, and potential hormonal influences, like during pregnancy or the postpartum period, which can be triggers. For male patients, education might emphasize recognizing the early warning signs of mania, developing strategies for impulse control, and understanding the potential for increased risk-taking behavior.
That's incredibly insightful. Recognizing those gender-specific patterns will definitely be helpful in practice. And how does bipolar disorder look different at various stages of life? This feels so important for you as nurses working with diverse patient populations from pediatrics to geriatrics, because it's clearly not a one-size-fits-all presentation.
Absolutely. Zooming out to see the broader context of developmental stages, the symptoms can be quite varied and sometimes, frankly, counterintuitive. In children and adolescents, for instance, depression often manifests not as typical adult sadness or withdrawal, but as intense rage, explosive irritability, and significant behavioral outbursts. This is thought to reflect the child's developmental level and perhaps their limited capacity for verbally articulating complex internal emotional states like despair or hopelessness.
Wow, so anger instead of sadness. That's a huge point for pediatric nurses.
It's a crucial point. Depression isn't always tears. It can be explosive anger that severely disrupts school performance and family life. Recognizing this is key to accurate assessment and avoiding misdiagnosis, maybe as ADHD or oppositional defiant disorder, which can delay appropriate treatment for years. Imagine Maria's younger sibling, maybe 10 years old, exhibiting persistent, unprovoked tantrums and aggressive behavior at school. That could be a significant red flag for an underlying mood disorder, including early onset bipolar disorder.
Okay, and what about at the other end of the spectrum in older adults?
For older adults, the presentation shifts again. They may exhibit greater neurological abnormalities and cognitive disturbances, things like memory issues or problems with executive function planning, organizing which can become more pronounced during mood episodes and really complicate the clinical picture. Interestingly, the incidence of mania tends to decrease somewhat with age, while depressive episodes might become more common or more prolonged. Geriatric nurses need to be acutely aware of these potential co-occurring issues and how they might complicate care. It requires careful differentiation from other age-related conditions like dementia or managing the complexities of polypharmacy. Older adults are often on many medications. A manic-like presentation in an older adult might also be more subtle. It might manifest more as agitation, confusion, or rapid, pressured speech, rather than the classic grandiosity or overt euphoria sometimes seen in younger patients.
Beyond the primary mood symptoms, what other conditions frequently appear alongside bipolar disorder? It seems pretty rare to see a patient with just one single issue, isn't it? Comorbidity feels like the norm in mental health care.
You're absolutely right. A crucial point here is the high rate of comorbidity, which significantly impacts treatment planning and really necessitates a truly holistic nursing approach. Our sources highlight that anxiety disorders are very common comorbidities. This includes things like panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, and social phobias. This means patients aren't just battling mood swings, they're often also struggling with persistent worry, fear, avoidance behaviors, things that can severely limit their quality of life even when their mood is relatively stable. Imagine Maria constantly battling social anxiety even during periods of euthymia or stable mood, making it difficult for her to maintain relationships or attend her support groups.
That adds another layer of complexity.
It certainly does. And even more critically, substance use disorders frequently co-occur. Often this starts as a form of self-medication. Patients might use alcohol or drugs to try and manage the uncomfortable symptoms of mania or depression, perhaps trying to come down from a manic high with alcohol or trying to lift themselves out of a depressive slump with stimulants.
Which then makes everything worse, right?
Exactly. This self-medication then severely complicates their mood stability, negatively impacts their overall physical health, and makes treatment adherence much more challenging. It creates a real vicious cycle. For nurses, recognizing and screening for these comorbid conditions anxiety, substance use is absolutely essential for a holistic assessment and for developing an integrated care plan. You simply can't treat the bipolar disorder effectively in isolation. You must address these co-occurring challenges to truly support the patient's long-term well-being and recovery. This often involves close collaboration with addiction specialists and tailoring interventions to address both conditions simultaneously.
It's also incredibly helpful, I imagine, to understand what can actually trigger an episode. Knowing these potential triggers seems like it could be a powerful tool for patient education and prevention, giving them some sense of agency and control over their condition. What are the common culprits we should know about?
Yes, this raises a really important question for patient self-management and education: identifying and mitigating triggers. Our sources list several common triggers for manic or depressive episodes. One of the biggest ones is lack of sleep or severely disrupted sleep patterns. Even just a few nights of insufficient sleep can rapidly precipitate a manic or hypomanic episode in susceptible individuals. For Maria, this might be pulling an all-nighter for an exam or just having a generally chaotic sleep schedule.
Sleep seems absolutely critical then.
It's fundamentally important. Interpersonal conflicts or disagreements with family, friends, or partners can also be significant stressors that destabilize mood, highlighting the importance of healthy relationship dynamics and communication skills. As we just discussed, alcohol and drug misuse are potent triggers, often making mood swings more severe, more unpredictable, and worsening that vicious cycle.
Are there other things, like medications?
Yes, certain medications can act as triggers, most notably antidepressants, when used alone, meaning without a concurrent mood stabilizer in someone with bipolar disorder, can sometimes induce mania, hypomania, or rapid cycling. This is especially a risk in patients with bipolar II who might have been misdiagnosed as having only major depression. And finally, pregnancy and hormonal changes can be significant triggers for mood episodes in women, highlighting the unique considerations for female patients, both during pregnancy and especially in the vulnerable postpartum period. Nurses have an absolutely vital role in educating patients and their families about these common triggers, and importantly, helping them develop practical, personalized strategies to minimize their impact. This might involve creating a detailed sleep hygiene plan with Maria, teaching her specific conflict resolution skills, helping her identify and avoid substance use triggers, or working closely with her and her psychiatrist around medication management if antidepressants are being considered. It's really about empowering them to be detectives of their own well-being and patterns.
And just briefly, what about the underlying causes?
Well, briefly, while the exact causes of bipolar disorder aren't fully understood, current theories involve complex interactions between genetics. It definitely has a strong hereditary component and biological factors, possibly including inflammation and neurotransmitter imbalances in the brain. This really reinforces that it's a physiological illness with significant neurological components. It's not a character flaw, it's not a weakness, it's not a choice. It's a biologically based illness that requires medical and therapeutic intervention.
So what does this all mean for you in your daily practice as a nurse? Let's dive into the practical steps now, the assessment process, and the absolute priorities in care. This is where your foundational knowledge translates directly into patient well-being, where observation meets intervention.
Right. A crucial point here is the sheer depth of information a nurse can gather through keen observation and targeted questioning within the psychological domain of nursing assessment. You are often the first line of defense, the professional consistently interacting with the patient, spending more time at the bedside or in the clinic with them than perhaps any other team member. You'll need to assess their mood, looking closely for those elevated, expansive, or irritable moods we talked about, signs of euphoria, and especially that mood lability, those rapid shifts. Nurses are often the first to observe these subtle or sometimes not so subtle shifts that might signal an impending episode or an acute crisis, maybe long before the physician makes their rounds. You might note Maria's speech becoming more rapid, her eyes seem brighter, her energy level is noticeably higher than it was yesterday.
So mood is key. What else?
Beyond mood, carefully observe activity levels. Is the patient pacing incessantly, unable to sit still during group therapy, demonstrating that profound psychomotor restlessness? Or conversely, are they profoundly lethargic, unmotivated, maybe struggling to even get out of bed for meals? These extremes are incredibly telling about their current mood state. Equally important are eating and sleep patterns. Note any significant changes. We know sleep deprivation is a major trigger for mania, and changes in appetite or eating habits are crucial indicators for both physical and mental well-being. Are they eating too much, too little? Monitor diet and body weight for fluctuations. Significant weight gain or loss can indicate the severity of mood episodes, or they could be troublesome side effects from medications, which is common. You might notice Maria picking at her food during a depressive phase, or conversely gaining significant weight, which might signal issues with a specific medication like olanzapine.
What about more sensitive areas?
Yes, you need to inquire discreetly and professionally about sexual practices. Why? Because increased impulsivity and disinhibition during manic phases can lead to risky sexual behaviors. This is a significant safety concern for the patient and potentially for others. You might frame this carefully by asking about changes in relationships, energy levels, or new interests. Physiologically, it's also important to assess thyroid function through laboratory testing as ordered by the physician. As we mentioned, a thyroid dysfunction can mimic or exacerbate mood symptoms, so ruling this out or managing it is a key physiological assessment. And lastly, but critically, a meticulous medication history is absolutely essential. Review all current and past medications, prescription, over-the-counter, herbal supplements to identify potential substance-induced symptoms or problematic medication interactions, like those antidepressants potentially triggering mania. Your comprehensive nursing assessment creates the blueprint for effective care. It allows you and the whole team to piece together the patient's full clinical picture.
When caring for a patient experiencing a bipolar episode, especially an acute one, maybe in the hospital, there's one overarching concern that guides everything else. It's the constant foundational priority. What is that primary focus for a nurse in these situations?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of patient well-being and our professional responsibility, safety is paramount. It is always number one, period. You are fundamentally responsible for protecting the patient from self-harm and protecting others, including staff and other patients, from potential aggression stemming from the patient's illness. Imagine Maria during an acute manic episode. Maybe she's experiencing delusions and is convinced she could fly from the hospital window, or perhaps she's intensely irritable and lashes out physically at another patient or staff member.
So how do you implement that safety?
Think about how a nurse implements this. It involves constant, vigilant observation, sometimes requiring one-on-one staffing. In extreme cases, it might involve the use of seclusion or restraints if less restrictive measures and de-escalation attempts fail to maintain safety. It means creating a meticulously safe physical environment, removing potential hazards like sharp objects, belts, cords, anything that could be used for self-harm or as a weapon. It involves utilizing advanced de-escalation techniques when agitation arises, speaking calmly and clearly, offering choices when possible, maintaining a non-threatening posture and personal space, setting clear limits on behavior. Ensuring a secure, predictable, and calm milieu or environment is fundamental to helping stabilize the patient during an acute phase. Your vigilance, your calm presence, your quick assessment, it can literally be the difference between life and death.
So safety first, always. Then what?
Following safety, the second priority nursing care issue is, naturally, mood management. Once safety is established or being actively managed, nurses work in close collaboration with the medical team to address and stabilize those severe mood fluctuations. This often involves administering medications as prescribed, carefully monitoring their effects, both therapeutic effects and side effects, and implementing various therapeutic interventions like providing structure, reducing stimuli, and offering brief supportive interactions to help bring the patient back towards a more stable baseline mood. But it bears repeating, without safety firmly established and maintained, none of that other crucial work can effectively happen.
Beyond the immediate crisis, the acute phase, what are the long-term aims of treatment? It's clearly not just about getting them through the hospital stay, right? For a chronic condition like bipolar disorder, what does success look like over a lifetime?
Right. This raises an important question about empowering patients for lifelong management, which is really a crucial part of nursing's long-term impact and contribution. The first major treatment goal is to minimize or prevent future mood episodes. We may not be able to cure bipolar disorder currently, but the goal is to achieve long periods of stability or euthymia. This is achieved through a combination of strategies. Consistent medication adherence is usually key, comprehensive patient and family education is vital, and various forms of therapy, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, or interpersonal and social rhythm therapy, IPSRT, are often very helpful. Nurses are instrumental in reinforcing medication schedules, explaining the rationale and importance of each medication, and helping patients troubleshoot adherence challenges, maybe addressing side effects, setting up reminders, or exploring long-acting injectable options if adherence is a major issue. You'll be teaching Marie about the likely consequences of missing doses and the significant benefits of consistency for maintaining stability.
And the education piece seems huge too.
Absolutely. The second, equally vital goal is patient and family education. This involves helping them truly understand the disorder itself, its genetic and biological underpinnings, its typical course, their specific triggers, how to recognize early warning signs of relapse, and developing effective coping strategies for lifetime management. As nurses, your teaching role here is invaluable. You're not just dispensing pills or providing direct physical care. You're empowering individuals and their support systems, their families, partners, close friends, with the knowledge and tools they need to live fulfilling lives despite having a chronic illness. This is where you equip Maria and her family with the practical how-to of managing her condition day to day, helping them identify her unique early warning signs. Perhaps for her, it's decreased sleep, increased spending, talking faster, or becoming more irritable, and then outlining concrete steps they can take together when those signs appear, whether that's contacting her psychiatrist, adjusting her sleep patterns immediately, initiating specific coping strategies they've learned, or reaching out to her support system for help.
Let's transition now to the comprehensive approach to managing bipolar disorder. Here's where it gets really interesting, I think, as we explore the tools available, from pharmacology to therapy and beyond. It's definitely a multifaceted approach needed for a complex condition, requiring a collaborative effort from the entire healthcare team, isn't it?
Yes, what's fascinating here is the truly multimodal approach needed for effective long-term treatment. And yes, medication often serves as a cornerstone, particularly for stabilizing acute mood episodes and preventing future relapses. When it comes to medication management, nurses play a crucial, very hands-on role in administration, ongoing monitoring, and comprehensive patient education. The primary medications used are typically mood stabilizers. Lithium, for instance, is often considered the gold standard, or the drug of choice for bipolar disorder, particularly effective for preventing both manic and depressive episodes.
Lithium seems really important, but I've heard it can be tricky to manage.
It is. For nurses, understanding its narrow therapeutic range is absolutely critical. Too little, and it's ineffective. Too much, and it can be toxic, even lethal. So you'll be teaching patients like Maria about maintaining consistent fluid intake and adequate salt intake to prevent dehydration or fluctuations in lithium levels. You'll teach them the early signs of toxicity, things like increased thirst, increased urination, fine hand tremors becoming coarse, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, muscle weakness, confusion, and you'll stress the crucial importance of keeping regular appointments for blood draws to monitor their lithium levels. Without these regular blood tests, lithium therapy is simply not safe or effective.
Okay, so lithium is key. What other medications are common?
Other vital mood stabilizers include anticonvulsant medications that have mood stabilizing properties. Examples include tegretol, carbamazepine, Dipakote, divalproic sodium, and Lamictal, lamotrigine, though Lamictal is often more effective for bipolar depression. Valproic acid is another common one, similar to Dipakote. Each of these has its own specific nursing considerations. For Depakote or Valproate, you'll be monitoring liver function tests and platelet counts and teaching about potential weight gain. For Tegretol, you need to be vigilant for potential blood dyscrasias, like a granulocytosis, and teach patients to report any unusual bruising, bleeding, fever, or signs of infection immediately. For Lamictal, the big concern is the potential for a serious rash, Stevens-Johnson syndrome, so you need to educate patients about reporting any new rash right away, especially during the initial titration phase. Additionally, antipsychotic medications are often used, particularly during acute mania or if psychotic features are present. Some, like Zyprexa, olanzapine, or Risperdal, risperidone, or Seroquel, also have mood stabilizing properties and can be used for maintenance treatment as well. So a solid knowledge of these medications, their mechanisms, common dosages, expected side effects, required monitoring protocols is critical for administering them safely and providing that essential education to your patients and their families. Nurses also collaborate closely with the entire healthcare team in supporting adjunct therapies, maybe adding an antidepressant carefully during depressive episodes, always with a mood stabilizer, using anxiolytics for anxiety, plus individual psychotherapy, family therapy, and support groups. It's about ensuring a truly holistic, integrated approach to care.
It's clearly not just about medication, though. What other therapies contribute significantly to stability and long-term well-being? You know, empowering patients like Maria with coping skills and building resilience beyond just pharmacology.
Right. This raises the important question about integrating psychological and social support into the treatment plan, which is vital. Therapeutic interventions are incredibly important for equipping patients with the skills they need to navigate life successfully with bipolar disorder. Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, for example, is a highly effective form of psychotherapy. It helps patients identify and challenge unhelpful, often distorted thinking patterns and modify behaviors that can contribute to mood instability or worsen episodes. A nurse might help reinforce CBT techniques discussed in therapy sessions, such as challenging negative automatic thoughts during depression or developing behavioral activation plans. You might encourage patients to practice skills learned in therapy, like mood tracking, identifying triggers, or using specific coping strategies.
So nurses can help bridge therapy into daily life.
Exactly. Family interventions and psychoeducation are also absolutely crucial. Bipolar disorder profoundly impacts the entire family system, so it's vital for family members, parents, partners, siblings to understand the illness, its symptoms, its typical course, and how they can best support their loved one without inadvertently enabling unhealthy behaviors or becoming completely burned out themselves. Nurses play a significant role in providing this education, answering their questions, normalizing their experiences, and referring families to appropriate resources like NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, or DBSA, Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, family support groups. And finally, support groups for patients themselves provide invaluable peer support. They allow individuals with bipolar disorder to share experiences, practical strategies, and reduce those profound feelings of isolation, helping them realize they are not alone in their struggles. Nurses are key in referring patients and families to these community resources, ensuring they have a robust network of support that extends beyond the clinical setting.
And care doesn't just stop once a patient leaves the hospital or the clinic door. What does the full continuum of care look like for someone managing a chronic condition like bipolar disorder? It sounds like it needs to be pretty adaptable, maybe as adaptable as the illness itself.
Yeah, bringing this into a wider lens, it's really about providing consistent, ongoing support through various levels of need, adapting the intensity of care as the patient's condition changes over time. The continuum of care for bipolar disorder is designed to be flexible and comprehensive, responding to the dynamic nature of the illness. It often starts, unfortunately, with inpatient management during acute episodes, providing that safe, structured environment needed for stabilization during severe manic, depressive, or mixed phases. This is where safety is the absolute priority, and intensive medication adjustments and monitoring occur.
Okay, so inpatient is the highest level. What comes after?
Once stable enough to leave the inpatient setting, patients like Maria might transition to less intensive but still highly structured settings. These could include intensive outpatient programs, IOPs, or partial hospitalization programs, PHPs. In these programs, patients typically receive daily treatment for several hours, maybe group therapy, individual sessions, medication management, psychoeducation, but they return home at night. Day hospitalization offers a similar structure. These programs serve as a crucial bridge between acute inpatient care and returning to full outpatient living in the community. The goal is to gradually step down the intensity of care as the patient gains stability and reinforces their coping skills, helping them build independence. Crucially, the continuum extends to extended and continued follow-up care in traditional outpatient settings, regular appointments with a psychiatrist for medication management, and a therapist for ongoing psychotherapy. This outpatient care is absolutely essential for long-term maintenance, early detection of relapse, ongoing medication adjustments, and sustained therapeutic support. As nurses, you'll be instrumental in helping patients navigate these transitions smoothly between different levels of care. This involves ensuring continuity of treatment plans, facilitating clear communication among various providers, and empowering patients to engage actively with their ongoing care responsibilities, everything from scheduling follow-up appointments to adhering consistently to their medication regimen.
Once a patient achieves remission, once that acute crisis has passed and their mood has stabilized, the focus naturally shifts, right? It moves towards maintaining that stability and promoting overall mental health. Okay, let's unpack this. What strategies are key during these periods of remission to help prevent relapse and foster a truly healthy, fulfilling life?
Right. A crucial point here is the proactive role patients can take with significant nursing guidance and support to manage their condition effectively long-term and truly enhance their quality of life beyond just symptom management. During remission periods, the emphasis shifts heavily towards mental health promotion and relapse prevention. This isn't just about avoiding symptoms, it's about actively building a healthier, more resilient lifestyle. Nurses are crucial educators and coaches in helping patients develop these life-sustaining habits and personalized plans.
What kind of habits are we talking about?
Key strategies include teaching and reinforcing effective stress management techniques. We know stress is a major trigger for both manic and depressive episodes, so learning how to cope effectively with life's inevitable demands is absolutely vital. This often goes hand in hand with practicing relaxation techniques and meditation, which can help regulate the nervous system, reduce ambient anxiety, and promote a sense of calm and centeredness. Regular exercise is another big one. It's not only good for physical health, but it also profoundly impacts mood and energy levels, acting as a natural mood booster and stabilizer for many people. Ensuring proper sleep hygiene is, as we've said, absolutely non-negotiable. Given that even minor sleep deprivation is such a potent trigger for manic episodes, consistency is key. Nurses can help patients establish consistent sleep-wake routines, create conducive sleep environments, dark, quiet, cool, and identify and address barriers to restful sleep.
Diet plays a role too, I assume.
A healthy diet certainly plays a role in overall brain health and well-being, though specific dietary interventions for bipolar disorder are still being researched. Eating regular balanced meals is generally supportive. Ultimately, the overarching goal during remission is the development and consistent use of a personalized symptom management plan, sometimes called a Wellness Recovery Action Plan, or WRAP plan. This plan is unique to each individual patient, and you'll collaborate closely with them to create it. It helps them identify their specific, subtle, early warning signs of an impending mood episode for Maria. Perhaps it's staying up later than usual, feeling more easily irritated, starting multiple new projects simultaneously, or having racing thoughts. And then the plan outlines concrete, specific steps she agrees to take when those signs appear. That might be contacting her psychiatrist or therapist immediately, implementing specific coping strategies they practice, making sure she gets extra sleep, reducing stimulation, avoiding alcohol, or reaching out proactively to her designated support person. Nurses are integral in collaborating with patients to create, refine, review, and adhere to these personalized relapse prevention plans. It's about empowering them to be active, informed participants in their own care, and giving them the practical tools they need to hopefully prevent a full-blown relapse or at least catch it early.
As we conclude our deep dive today, it feels vital to acknowledge the most serious potential outcomes associated with bipolar disorder. This isn't just about managing mood swings. Unfortunately, it's sometimes about preventing tragedies. This thought is obviously sobering, but it really underscores the immense responsibility you will carry as nurses.
Yes, this raises an important and indeed sobering question that truly underscores the potential severity of the illness and the absolute criticality of our role as nurses. The worst outcome for a patient with bipolar disorder is, tragically, death. This can occur either directly through suicide, which is a significantly elevated risk compared to the general population, especially during depressive or mixed episodes, or sometimes indirectly through destructive behaviors resulting from severely impaired judgment during acute mood episodes, things like reckless accidents or dangerous encounters. This grim reality reinforces why continuous risk assessment, meticulous safety planning, and comprehensive, consistent care are absolutely non-negotiable for nurses working in every setting where they might encounter these patients. Imagine Maria in the depths of a severe depression feeling hopeless, or during an intense manic episode feeling invincible, making a decision that permanently alters her life or tragically ends it.
It really brings it all back to safety.
It brings us back, full circle, to our core principle. Safety is paramount. Always, always prioritize protecting the patient from self-harm and, when necessary, protecting others from the patient's potential aggression, which is usually rooted in fear, confusion, or irritability from the illness itself, not malice. This is not just a nursing priority written in a textbook. It's a core ethical responsibility that you, as future nurses, must internalize from day one of your practice. Your vigilance, your astute assessment skills, your ability to build rapport even in difficult circumstances, your empathetic yet firm interventions, your knowledge of de-escalation techniques, these skills can literally save lives. The consequences of not prioritizing safety in the care of individuals with bipolar disorder are profound and potentially irreversible, making this aspect of care the single most critical consideration in their management.
So what does this all mean for you as you embark on your incredible and challenging journey in nursing? Our deep dive into bipolar disorders today highlights that caring for these patients is undeniably complex, yet it can also be incredibly rewarding. You've learned about the distinct mood states, that euphoria, the expansive mood, the profound irritability, the rapid alubiability. You've got a handle on the different types of bipolar disorder, from the intense full manic episodes of bipolar 1 to the more subtle, often hidden hypomania of bipolar 2, and the chronic fluctuations of cyclothymic disorder. You've understood how it can manifest differently across the lifespan, maybe intense rage in children, cognitive changes in older adults, and crucially, you've grasped the paramount importance of safety in your nursing care. You now have a solid understanding of the comprehensive assessment process, the core treatment goals, minimizing episodes, and empowering patients and families through education, the essential medication management strategies with key drugs like lithium, and the comprehensive continuum of care needed to support these patients throughout their lives. Remember, this isn't just academic knowledge for a test. These are the foundational tools you'll use every single day on the job to make a real, tangible difference in people's lives. So here's a final thought to take with you. Considering the significant impact of early diagnosis and intervention on the long-term course of bipolar disorder, how might you, as a nurse, uniquely contribute to identifying at-risk individuals and advocating for timely support, perhaps even in settings beyond traditional mental health units? Remember, this condition often begins before age 25. Children can present with symptoms like intense rage, which might easily be dismissed as just behavioral problems. Your keen observational skills, your holistic assessment abilities, maybe in pediatric clinics, school health offices, urgent care centers, or even on general medical floors, could make a profound difference. You might be the first person to notice the pattern, to connect the dots, catching these signs early and helping to link patients to the specialized care they desperately need. Keep learning, keep asking questions, and above all, keep advocating fiercely for your patients.